I'm Matt from Solidarity House Cooperative. On Election Day this week, voters in Los Angeles defeated a measure that would have amended the city charter to allow the city to create a banking enterprise. It was a measure designed to make it easier to create a public bank in Los Angeles. As my former colleague Mark Armstrong explains, the measure was complex, perhaps unnecessary, and fiercely opposed by the private financial industry and a lot of media pundits, including the editorial board of the LA Times, who didn't really seem to understand public banking. Mark says that it also faced opposition from people who are just generally skeptical of or hostile to Los Angeles city government. And in spite of all that, with only 3 months and very little money to educate the public, well over 40% of voters approved the measure. Not a majority, but a sizable number for such a complicated and new measure. Mark Armstrong co-founded the Public Banking Institute in 2011. I worked with Mark at PBI and later at Commonomics USA, where he has served as president since opening up shop there in 2014. And I wanted to hear his thoughts on the day after the election loss, since he'd spent several months in LA building support for the measure.
I think there are broader ramifications, but it's also true that the playing field was not level. I mean, you know, folks were going into this with a surprise ballot measure, and we had 3 short months to pull a campaign together. And given that we were trying to get something passed, which the vast majority of voters had never heard of before, and if anything, they would have a negative reaction to it because of the way they've been brainwashed to think about government as well as about banking. To get 267,000 votes is really indicative that the voting population is willing to be swayed on something like this and can support it. So I look at it as a real win to get that many votes. We certainly didn't get another 100,000 or so that we needed. People from other cities can read a little bit into this, but I would not go too far. I look at this more as a baseline that, okay, given that the deck was stacked against Public Bank LA, given that they virtually had no money whatsoever, that didn't, $60,000 didn't materialize until the last 3 weeks, that even so, they were able to get this number of votes. If this were on the ballot for 2 years from now, and they had a ramp to lead up to that, then I think it would have easily cleared 50%. There's a fundamental problem that I'm trying to figure out, and I thought just by talking with you, it might help to kind of illuminate what the issue was. First of all, the charter does not prohibit a public bank. The LA's charter does not prohibit a public bank. Mm-hmm. It simply says that the city is prohibited from engaging in a purely commercial enterprise. And so that is a surprise then that the city attorney recommended that the only path forward then would be to have a charter amendment vote. You know, a public bank can be created that simply refinances public debt. And so you're simply using public deposits in a public institution to create public credit to refinance public debt. Mm-hmm. So that's not a purely commercial enterprise. There's no prohibition in the charter against that. And which means you could interpret this vote as basically the business community prohibiting a public bank from offering low-cost loans to their business community. What was missing in the lead-up to this charter amendment is this kind of discussion with city leaders who could more wisely choose a path forward. Instead, they put this measure forward, and it was really insufficient. I mean, had a very limited description as to what was being done without any sort of pointers to a much bigger picture of what's happening with this. Mm-hmm. And so without those pointers and with the kind of inherent inadequacies of the way the measure was written, even so, we got, 267,000 votes, but there needed to be a lot more education provided. And, you know, we didn't have the time, nor did we have money. So
mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to.
I saw
roughly half a dozen op-eds in various LA-based publications. Like, you know, this is a terrible idea. Banks run by the government. Do you feel like the movement there lacked the infrastructure and the human resources to be able to kind of answer that back and turn those op-eds into opportunities for debate and dialogue?
I think that was a part of it. I would say that we could have addressed that. I think there was a bigger issue, which was a surprise to me when I first got out there, and that is that there's this really intense hatred for city government officials. And so you had a large number of folks giving voice to this disdain for the city council people.
Folks who otherwise should have been allies or what you would think would be allies.
I always have the assumption that as politics get more local, there's a lot more dissimilarities between left and right, and people are much more practical and engaged, and there's more of a spirit of okay, let's solve problems for each other. We're all working towards that. But what I saw in LA was this intense hatred for government. People just saying, what has government done for you lately? What the same old argument about they can't fill potholes, but you expect them to run a bank. The coalition, if you look at the coalition that was built by Public Bank LA, that was hugely significant, but there was no time to have many of the members email out to the member organizations to email out to their members, individual members, to vote for this measure, as well as to educate them a little bit on public banking. There is virtually no time for that. The coalition of organizational members is indicative of how well supported this is. Unfortunately, we just ran out of one runway, I think.
Matt again from Solidarity House Cooperative. Senator Kamala Harris recently proposed a new tax credit, the LIFT credit, which pays people an amount equal to 100% of their earnings or Pell Grant benefits, up to a maximum of $3,000 for a single person and $6,000 for a married couple. Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project, a progressive economic think tank that you should definitely support, has long been a skeptic of trying to use the earned income tax credit and tax schemes in general as methods of economic redistribution. Elaine Mogg of the Urban Institute's Tax Policy Center worked on the LIFT proposal, and she agrees that the tax system and EITC are not wholly suited for the kinds of reconceptions of money, work, and economic justice we may have before us as a society. But she does think that there are parts of that system worth saving. I talked to both Elaine and Matt a couple of weeks ago.
I want to start with Elaine. How did we get to the point where we have these multiple tiers and types of credit proposals? Seems like it's, that it can get very political. People have different proposals. From your perspective of writing these, where are we at in that kind of big picture?
So I think the way we got here is more politics than anything. We sort of went through a period where we decided that it would be efficient to administer programs through the tax system. It was more popular to give a tax cut than to give a transfer program increase. And so something like the EITC was born. It was also an answer to an early proposal for a negative income tax. There's some good things about doing this through the tax system. It is efficient. Almost everyone who qualifies for the EITC will be filing a tax return anyway. You don't have to take off work to go to an office to apply for benefits. There's no stigma associated with it. Everyone's filing a tax return. There's not, a caseworker looking at you trying to determine if you're truly deserving or not deserving. And as a result, we get really high participation rates in these tax programs. And they also lift more people out of poverty than any other program outside of Social Security, more working age people out of poverty, I should say. But the downside to this is that the IRS's mission is not to deliver benefits, and it's it's not the thing they're best at doing. They don't have social workers reviewing tax forms. They have revenue agents. They're also not good at reaching the entire population. Particularly, they're not good at reaching people who don't work. And finally, the IRS delivers benefits annually, typically in spring, the year after you qualify for them, unlike transfer programs, which can deliver contemporaneous benefits.
Matt, your thoughts on some of those big picture questions and the sense in which this is, you know, really is a political question.
So I'm a little bit less familiar with the history. I've read other people who seem to be familiar with it. And one aspect of it that deserves emphasizing is that there seems to be a preference for these programs in part because they provide benefits to what we might think of as the deserving poor, people who go out and work and put in hours, as opposed to people who maybe don't work at all. The tax code design helps facilitate that to some degree, because if you're providing the benefits based on earnings, then you have a very easy way to record that at the end of the year and top people off. I guess one other thing is, when it comes to stigma, I think it's worth emphasizing that it's true, of course, that EITC is going to have or has historically had less stigma than, say, aid to families with dependent children or temporary assistance for needy families or food stamps or things like that, but not less stigma than, say, Social Security or Medicare. So there seems to be at least three kinds of benefits, right? One is these sort of big universal programs that are just on budget transfer programs. Those don't seem to have much stigma at all. In fact, no stigma, I would say. Then you have these tax credits, which seem to be submerged and don't really carry on much stigma, in part because they're so hidden. And then you have this third group, which is these means-tested benefits. You have to go to a welfare office and that sort of thing. And so the question partially needs to be, you know, which of those three types do we want to use, I think.
Elaine, is this a question, too, of kind of who's sitting in the room making these decisions and kind of whose interests are being represented? I know you've said that, you know, in doing the work you do, you work with a lot of sort of different constituents of varying, you know, levels of social power. Is that, do you feel like that's accurate?
You know, for better or worse, since, you know, as far back as welfare reform, when the EITC sort of went through a big expansion or relatively big expansion, the people in the room have been saying, you know, make work pay. If you work, you shouldn't be poor. They absolutely have been making the distinction that, you know, Matt has made, that there's a group of people who are deserving of assistance and there are a group of people who are not. And unfortunately, unless you're old and not expected to work, then to claim that deserving tag from the people who are, you know, policymakers at the federal level, in most cases, you need to be working.
And working in a very specific sense of work, working in the sense that you earn, you know, what is considered income. Matt, your dissatisfaction with this is not necessarily in sort of the intrinsic logic of it in terms of doing what it sets out to do, but from a political perspective of how this perpetuates an assumption and maybe perpetuates it with such power that it might undermine our ability to make policy that, you know, such as the Brown-Bennett child allowance or other things like that, that might actually help more of maybe the neediest folks.
The normative judgment at the heart of these programs that phase in is very toxic. If you come from a sort of egalitarian perspective that really emphasizes the most vulnerable, the poorest people in society. And I think we've seen after the rise of the EITC and this and the child tax credit and the decline of traditional welfare, there have been a lot of papers saying that, in fact, the very, very poor, those with incomes below half the poverty line, that their ranks have actually swelled over that period. And so there are real tangible consequences to emphasizing, you know, the deserving poor over the undeserving poor that are really negative to those populations. You get high extreme poverty, high deep poverty. It's not a good result. That doesn't mean I necessarily object to having any kind of phase in. I mean, in my ideal setup, as I think about it right now, you would have an earned income tax credit that was sort of one line instead of four lines that had nothing to do with the number of children you had. And then you would have a universal child allowance that would bring in together the child-related parts of the EITC, the child independent care credit, the what's left of the dependent exemption, I guess, when it comes back in, all the other sort of child-based credits we have in the tax code, consolidate those, bring those under the family of universal programs, even call it, you know, Social Security children or whatever, just like we have Social Security old age and disability, bring that stuff over there. You're going to get way more bang for your, you're going to get way better outcomes for not just children, but also people, because children mostly live with working age people, instead of doubling down on another earned income tax credit, which is what Kamala Harris's bill does. It's basically a second earned income tax credit with somewhat different parameters. It's also what Ro Khanna and Sherrod Brown's bill does. They just sort of double the earned income tax credit. Instead of keep doing those trapezoids when we already have a couple of them, let's try to get back into the world of doing Social Security-like programs that are actually going to benefit the poorest among us without creating stigma and all the problems that occurred with things like AFDC.
So I think you bring up a really important point that I would love to see actually a system that subsidizes workers separate from children. There's lots of reasons to do it for exactly what you say, well-being is key among them. It also makes it a lot easier to administer. The whole issue with the EITC compliance is always about trying to figure out where a child lives. We know children are moving between multiple houses over the course of the year, but they only get to sit in one tax unit at the end of the year. And that creates a world of trouble for the IRS and administration. So that's one thing I like about the Kamala Harris bill is she's sort of, you know, not basing her benefit at all on the existence of children. Instead, you know, it's if you have a single person, you get up to $3,000. And if you are a married couple, you get up to $6,000. The other thing I would point out with the trapezoid structure, I guess two things, one on both sides. The reason the trapezoid structure becomes really popular is because it's been shown to be a pretty big incentive to work. So there's a lot of studies that compare mostly single mothers who were the primary beneficiaries of the early EITC with adults without children or without custodial children. And we introduce the EITC and they come into the workforce. And, you know, that can make the economy grow. There can be some good side effects to that. So that's one reason why we sort of perpetuate this structure, though I agree with you, we have probably driven it as far as it can be driven. And thinking about universal benefits is certainly an appropriate thing to do. The Harris bill does do one thing that's a little bit of step into redefining work and trying to get away from having to have earnings. And that is she includes your Pell amount as the same, it's counted the same as wages. And so by that metric, it's one way we find low-income students, and they don't need to be engaging in traditional work to be able to benefit from her program. So that's sort of one argument in favor of her bill and also in favor of these trapezoid structures. The argument against it, besides what you point out, is that I worry that if we solve the problem of poverty for most people by giving them enough tax credits, then there's no one left to sort of fight for the people who are truly in dire straits. And those are the people that are excluded from the trapezoid structure. So you definitely want to be careful about going too far in expanding the EITC or worker credit programs, because you could end up at the end of the day with most people feeling pretty good about everything and receiving substantial benefits and a few incredibly deserving people being left out entirely. You know, the bottom line is you're trying to get your policy to, you know, a senator's desk. And You know, it sort of depends what the senator thinks the future of work is. If the future of work is that there's going to be a lot of junky jobs available that can't support people, then you want to do a worker credit. And so people will still have jobs, but we'll make them, you know, actually provide a living wage by these credits. If you think instead the future of work is that the jobs will be gone, that the robots will be doing everything we do, then, you know, these tax credits aren't going to do anything at all. And so I think it sort of depends where you think, you know, what you think the economy looks like in 10, 20 years. And then how you get someone to focus on that is an excellent question. I have trouble getting people to do that.
The utility of tax policy for egalitarian purposes really is contingent on what the concept of jobs is, which, you know, as we know, is just a really rich field of speculation right now.
Tax policy operates on earnings and capital income. And so, you know, that's going to limit your terrain. Students don't usually have either. Stay-at-home parents don't have either. Disabled people often don't have either. So, you know, there's a whole group of people which consists of, I guess, around half of society who are not working at any given time. And tax policy is going to struggle a little bit to reach those people, or struggle a lot in some cases. So, yeah, I mean, that's an inherent issue.
So another issue is this, you know, what I tried to bring up at the beginning is tax policy today is good at delivering benefits one time a year when you get your tax refund after you file. Transfer policy is much better at determining need and delivering benefits contemporaneously. So Social Security Administration, right, they're cutting checks every month to different groups of people. TANF and SNAP, same thing. You get a benefit, you know, on a monthly basis. You know, most of the SNAP regulations have been liberalized a touch so that you're not constantly having to recertify. And, you know, if you don't have cash, that's a good thing to be able to get these cash benefits on a monthly basis. And of course, the Harris bill wants the benefit to be delivered in advance. You have an option to take it in advance. But to date, the IRS hasn't figured out a way to do that. And the second issue is when we did have the option to do that, it died maybe 10 years ago, very few people actually took an advanced credit. And they said they didn't take the credit in advance, partly because they didn't know about it, but also because people are terrified about having to pay taxes when they reconcile them, you know, in spring. And so they can solve this problem, though, with universal benefits. And if you won't make them universal, if you at least cut off the last tail of that trapezoid, so the benefits don't phase out. And that way, you know, you're not going to have to pay your $3,000 or $6,000 back. You're getting it. And then you can always make it budget neutral by raising rates at the high end. And then it's, you know, more transparent and I would say offers some benefits.
Isn't there still a problem in the phase in if you're doing a refundable credit? Because like in Kamala's bill, if I predict I'm going to make $6,000, but then I actually make $3,000 and I get the $6,000 credit, you know, advanced to me, would I then have to pay the $3,000 back since I got too much?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's very few people that will sit anywhere on that phase in. Almost everyone who qualifies for a dollar of credit is going to qualify for the maximum credit.
Thoughts on the general utility of tax policy, maybe the limits of it, and maybe what things to focus on insofar as we do want to make use of tax policy?
I mean, for me, I generally don't like benefits in tax code. Obviously, I recognize political limitations and that sort of thing. But in an ideal structure, you know, the purpose of the tax code is to raise revenue and then put as much as you can into normal welfare state programs. You know, we have a lot of stuff that we could still do in the U.S. that is fairly typical in other countries. We could have, you know, municipal child care that is free or heavily subsidized. We could have a child allowance. You could give free health care to everyone in the U.S. with Medicare for All. You know, the usual set of things, benefits for elderly people, disabled people, students, caregivers, the unemployed, all those things could be beefed up. And that's really where most of the poverty happens. And then from there, you know, what the tax code can do is if it's progressive enough, it can also trim down inequality on that side of the ledger. But more on the side of, you know, trimming down the disposable incomes of the rich rather than trying to pump up the disposable incomes of, you know, the middle and lower class.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's certainly, you know, how the tax system started. It used to be that very few people paid the federal income tax. And that was intentional. It was designed to do exactly what you're saying, trim the incomes at the very top. I still, in my heart, will advocate for these sorts of policies in the tax system because I don't see any game happening on the transfer side. And so I think, well, I can't let perfect be the enemy of good. And I'm reaching most people. And I think that's a good thing to continue doing, but I certainly appreciate what you're saying, that it doesn't touch everyone and it should always be paired with some thinking about the transfer system and how we bring those benefits to people, to all people, not just people who we've decided are in that deserving group.
Yana Ludwig, another member of Solidarity House Cooperative, recently spoke with Noni Session and Greg Jackson, who are part of the very innovative East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. This Oakland-based cooperative's mission is to develop cooperative affordable real estate alternatives that empower people to create intentional communities that are ecologically, emotionally, spiritually, culturally, and economically regenerative.
Noni Session. I am the director of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. We are a multi-stakeholder cooperative in that we are a real estate investment cooperative, or what one might call a consumer co-op, run by an internally embedded staff cooperative. And we are the staff stewards of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative's mission, which is to remediate racialized housing injustice and rapid displacement through aggregating capital from impact investors, but particularly from community investments, one might call it a solidarity fund, in order to organize people, access and steward land collectively, land that will never go back onto the speculative market, and land that where we've designed financial performance to keep the rents, if you will, permanently affordable. So we steward land in our community to stop the injustices happening right now in Oakland and the East Bay, and really spreading across the nation.
Hey, so my name is Greg Jackson. I'm a Equal Justice Works Fellow at the Sustainable Economies Law Center, and I also serve as the Partnerships Director for the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. For the next 2 years, like, my focus is really training, educating, and doing workshops for Black communities so that we begin to reconnect to our roots of cooperative enterprise and begin to start building more sovereignty and autonomy within our communities.
Noni, you used a phrase a minute ago, remediate racialized real estate. And I would love you to like tease that apart a little bit and talk about like what does that mean, racialized real estate, and what are you all actually doing to try to remediate that?
What I said was remediate racialized displacement. Housing injustice.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, great.
And so I think remediate is a term that I have picked up from two fields. My background is pretty varied. I come from a family of people who are educators, and my mom in particular was a special ed teacher. So remediate is in one field. In the education field, you find it used in the capacity of, it's a term that's about going back, right? And repairing and patching cracks and damage that, in this case, if we're speaking about children, that they've received that caused them to have a patchy academic performance or personal performance in terms of their academic goals. So you bring in special resources to remediate. Another field where you find the term remediation, which is especially impactful, is in the environmental field. So you do things, and in gardening and permaculture, right? Mm-hmm. The thing we know that's happening in the urban area, in order for us to begin to even build food security, is you have to remediate the soil, right? You have to go back to the soil, and there's two chunks of phrasing and remediate. You have to go back to the soil and you have to renew the medium itself, right? You have to change the content of the soil, and you have to, in order to change the way that resources are transmitted to the soil and the person eating from the soil. So when we talk about remediating racialized housing displacement, we're talking about going back work in the process. So a lot of the solutions that are being created for rapid displacement in Bay Area and in the Bay Area nationwide are solutions that do not acknowledge the toxicity in the soil, that they do not acknowledge the extractive and life-taking processes that fuel and support housing displacement in general, and specifically racialized housing displacement. So we're trying to take a few steps backward and think about the systemic solutions rather than the band-aids to just get someone in a house. There's so many steps in between being a human who has a basic need and being able to meet that need in industrialized, capitalized environments such as we're living in right now, particularly with unchecked real estate speculation, and particularly the way that people of color, Black, Indigenous, and people of color tend to sink to the bottom of the access ladder when we're talking about what is typically described as a housing shortage, which that's not actually the case. There's an affordable housing shortage, but there is a glut of housing in the Bay Area, and there is a huge vacancy rate. So that's a whole other can of worms I ended with, but
Go ahead, Greg.
For a moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah, Greg wants to add to that. I think that's great.
Great.
So, pushing forward the idea of remediation, one of our mission pillars is heal people power, because we recognize that in order to cultivate democratic, nonviolent governance amongst ourselves, we have to think about the habits and the behaviors that we've taken on from this society. And we have to begin to heal ourselves from that extractive mindset if we're to collectively do very much. We see this as very central to our goal of making sure that we incorporate a healing element, going back to Indigenous practices, holding space so that we're not forced to move too fast, because that's the way that capital moves, as opposed to moving at a human pace and taking the time to build the relationships, because that's primarily important.
I love the ways that you two are both talking about this, that it's about healing, that it's about moving away from an extractive economy and extractive ways of thinking about things, and also going sort of backward in the process and slowing things down to a human pace. So all of that feels really rich and really important. You know, Greg, you said that your role is, partly about educating Black folks about their cooperative roots. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, there's a very, very interesting book, Collective Courage, by Jessica Gordon Nemhart. And in that book, she chronicles what Black people were doing post-emancipation and pretty much up into desegregation, a little bit past that. And what she found was that in every center where Black people were, we were cooperating at a mass scale. And we had cooperative grocery stores, buying clubs. There were mutual aid societies. There were CLTs in America. Their roots are in this the civil rights movement, and trying to find places for recently released I don't like saying that word, but anyway, these they're trying to find places for Black people to have some autonomy and have a place where we can rest, regain that bit of ourselves that was lost in that process. So the history of Black cooperatives has unfortunately been lost. And what I hope to do is, in the Bay Area in particular, there's a lot of cooperatives and a lot of technical assistance providers here in Oakland. So what I hope to do is show people that this is not a foreign concept. Like, our ancestors were doing this, and they received that inclination, that knowledge from their ancestors. Like, this is a very natural thing that basically everyone throughout the globe has done until what we call capitalism has taken hold. What I would like to do is show people what has been and help them imagine what they can do with collective effort and then bring the resources that are needed so that people are held and are able to move into that like very rocky transition, because we're not taught how to cooperate. We're in fact, you know, taught how to take orders and do this like top-down thing. So I'm working out ways to first reach out and then help people build up their own interest in it, and after that point then give them the resources they need to make it happen, whatever their dreams are.
Noni, I'll come back to the question that I have for you about your research, but I want to dovetail into Greg's right now, because it probably is related to what he was just saying. So you did some interesting research while you were in law school about the international cooperative movement, and I'm curious what you learned in that research and how it affects how y'all are doing your organizing today.
I was interning with the Sustainable Economy Law Center during law school, about two different stints. And in between that, I was also doing independent study research because I was just like really fascinated with this idea of cooperatives. And the first thing I researched was the Marcora Law in Italy, which was a program that, if I'm not mistaken, is no more. But while it was going on since 1985, it gave people the option of collectivizing their money that they would have received from unemployment, so that they can start a cooperative. The Marcora Law also created a fund so that businesses that were either failing or about to be moved away, it would give the workers the money to purchase the business and operate it cooperatively rather than have it leave. And like, that was really powerful in the sense of like, the government is like not only helping people, but also like giving them the fishing rod rather than the fish, which I really respected. And I also like learned a lot about what's going on in Central and South America, how like cooperatives are very strong there. And in fact, the government like recommended cooperatives as a development tool like in the 60s. And like basically since that point in Brazil, in Uruguay, in Argentina, the cooperative movements are very strong and actually are regionally connected. And Argentina in particular had a lot of recuperation of factories that were going out of business because foreign investors got all the money that they could, extracted as much as they wanted, and were now moving operations to another place that was cheaper. They were basically leaving whole regions impoverished. And the workers there began to organize and started occupying their factories and eventually buying them from the capitalists. Further down the line, they even got the government to create legislation that would help further the process. So there's been a lot of like very interesting work that's been going on around the world, and how it affects like my viewpoint on things is that as soon as people realize that they can collectivize is the point that we can change things. Up until that point, folks may be under the illusion that they need someone else or they need capital from elsewhere to get things done. But a lot of times, like, the power of the people is what forces the government or capital to basically give the people what they want, because at the end of the day, the governments are supposed to be a representation of the people and echo what the people want. And when citizens and residents are like very intentional about telling the government or just speaking to power in general and saying this is what's going to happen, it tends to work out. The only thing more that I can think of is like looking at Brazil and Africa in particular and how they're dealing with slum development. I'm forgetting the better word for it.
Is it favela?
Tenement housing, basically.
So much of the
world is living in impoverished conditions, and it's only getting worse. For example, in Nairobi, Noni and I have links to Nairobi, and she can talk about that, about her links. But I was there trying to research a community land trust project that the government had done in Voi, Kenya, and it was touted as like the way of the future by many, like in the 90s, but it kind of petered out. The problem of homelessness, houselessness, and slum housing affects the globe. That is not an accident. Like, that is how capital works. It's really sad to see the same thing happening here. I always hated going to San Francisco because over there, the homeless population is out of control, and everyone there, or too many people, overlook the homeless, and there's a feeling like they don't see them as people. Mm-hmm. And that has been starting to creep into Oakland, and I'm feeling this global pressure of pushing everyone into these tenements or displacing everyone from their land. I'm feeling it really heavy here. Personally, it's been hard to feel this sense of urgency and still leave a place for spaciousness. But, you know, that's my work.
Noni, in your biography on the PREC website, it says that you did your doctoral work looking at ethnographic analysis of international humanitarian strategies and their on-the-ground consequences. So that sounds really interesting. So what did you learn when you were doing your doctoral work, and what conclusions were you able to draw about humanitarian work?
My area is anthropology. I look at symbolic and cultural production in Western bureaucracies and disciplinary models. So I was basically working on studying development or humanitarian bureaucrats installed as representatives in an urban African space like Nairobi. The connections to what I'm doing now weren't really strongly made until I returned, but my original work found its roots in undergraduate while I was doing some senior project work, making a connection between, I'm a third generation native West Oaklander, and my parents grew up in the projects, and although they were able to start a few businesses and buy a house for the family, our whole life was deeply intertwined with the municipal neglect that was characteristic of deep West Oakland, which is where I live now. I'm in my family house, or what they call the lower bottoms. So that is geographically and socially, that's an apt name, the lower bottoms. So although I was insulated from a lot of the consequences of poverty, it was just because we had a gate and a door and a roof. Everything was right outside of our door. And so some of my undergraduate work as a rising senior was making a connection between one of my most influential theorists, Foucault, and his work around the carceral state and disciplining certain kinds of bodies in relationship to certain kind of regiments of rule. I did my undergraduate work on police officers and the social services institution, because I was also a single mother. So my daughter and I was a teen mother, actually. So my daughter and I had a lot of encounters with social services institutions while we were struggling to get on our feet. And that led me into anthropology and understanding that these frameworks of Western production that we think of as objective and neutral, such as the bureaucrat or the humanitarian service model, although we take them to be objective, they're actually modes of cultural production. So I approached my work in Nairobi as a study of a cultural group, which is you and I and all the other disciplinarians who come and produce claims about the world and then create frameworks that accommodate those claims, disciplinary frameworks that accommodate those claims. Forgive me for getting complicated, but I'm trying to sort of lay out the connection between there and here. So what I really saw was disciplines that are sort of pre-programmed with particular visions of how they hope to transform the world, and development, embedded in its very name, is about a transformative process. And those transformative processes you could characterize as global flows of culture and capital, often going one way. And those arrivals of expatriate community communities installed in Nairobi, those arrivals of buzzwords and institutional language that's used to interpret the experience and the work happening in the Greater Horn of Africa, those particular models of cultural production like conferencing, producing documents, language-like, for lack of a better term, language-like partnerships. All of those objects, all of those cultural artifacts functioned to disappear the actual place under consideration, and that was, in my case, Nairobi and the Greater Horn of Africa. So all of these productive works that were actually producing an amazing amount of capital for the people who were supposed to be serving these folks. So you got to understand that the international development mega complex, right? We talk about the nonprofit industrial complex. The nonprofit industrial complex in the U.S. takes its cues from the international development complex, right? So countries are strong-armed into billions of dollars of debt. The debt then pays for these large bureaucratic and corporate endeavors to bring over experts to these continents, and we pay the money that the countries are servicing in debt back to the very organizations that leverage and strong arm the countries into the debt relationship in the first place. So we're talking about World Bank, IMF, UNDP, World Health Organization. These are all loan-based and debt-based services, and that is in inverted commas services. Cultural production was being transplanted. Sovereignty was being overstepped through these culturally rationalized explanations, and then it all being wrapped up in a very sort of objective for the good of the world package was astonishing enough to experience over the course of 2 years. And then when I came back home after having moved away from home in 2001 and coming back home by 2011, I found a very much transformed landscape. The landscape I left before was a landscape that was still, what I didn't realize at the time, at the end of a very critical process to rapid displacement, which is extreme municipal neglect, right? And then you have a population that is discouraged, underserviced, disenfranchised from the political machinations of their center, that is for us downtown Oakland City Hall. You have a deflation of property prices, a few bubbles, and then there's a rapid inflation that brings in a lot of unchecked revenue and businesses because people have experienced the state of the city in such a desperate manner. They're willing to let city leaders accept any deal, and that's an inverted commas deals, when in fact what we don't understand is there's a long planning process that leads one to the place of rapid displacement. And when I came back, I saw the outcomes again of more global flows of capital and global flows of culture coming in with the presumption that its power of capital also held with it the right to transform and change landscapes. So we're talking about a repeat of a narrative again and again, starting from colonials arriving at the shores of places where people were already living, arriving with a vision for their own world, a way to create resources for the oppressions and the lacks that they were fleeing from that required them to map over the top of people already existing there with a piece of their world and a piece of their vision. So what I saw was basically a cyclical process, as Gregory might call it, or Mike Davis might call it, is the slum planet, where these capital processes to maintain this particular quality of life that you find in about three countries, it requires the eating of all bodies, not just Black, Indigenous, and people of color bodies. All bodies grind through the mill of capital production. So the connection between those is that the story of the discipline, the story of bureaucracy, the story of governance, the story of law or anthropology tells a story that really supports its own survival. There has to be a story that we retell to ourselves as people, that we understand that those are contingent fictions, not facts, right? And as long as we treat capital and capital production as a fact, we will continue along this road to the slum planet. If we retell our story and remember our story and remediate, we change the air through which we perceive. We can divert this pathway despite what's happening at a larger scale.
Sounds like there's a big element to how you all have put together what you're doing, that, you know, what I would call a kind of solidarity consciousness or class consciousness that has awareness of all of these racialized dynamics that are at play, but also are really, as you say, about the fact that, like, all of our bodies are ultimately subject to the forces of capital that's being moved around over top of, you know, whether it's in Nairobi or Oakland or Mississippi or Detroit or, like, wherever that's happening, that there's this big pattern language that you all are in touch with that feels to me like it has a big solidarity and class piece to it as well.
And as I'm learning, you know, I've been the little kid that's had my face in books forever. and so when I encountered things like Marxism, I thought, wow, how awesome. That's what I've been thinking my whole life. But I'm learning as I'm deeper into the political field and this field of, I wouldn't even call this the development field we're in. We're trying to do something that we haven't seen really happening, or rather, we haven't seen happening in the Bay Area, but we have seen it happening in the South. So mm-hmm. The South is our model. Reviving a conversation around class consciousness is a bit inflammatory, I'm learning. We're going around delivering the message to anyone who will care to hear, because there is a need to really revive this conversation. So we were delivering the message at a climate compassion salon, and I mentioned to me what was a run-of-the-mill phrase, or rather a given, in that we must reclaim our means of production. We must. That capital knows that the means of production is where power rests. So we as people and communities must also be clear about that awareness. And after a friend of mine, another academic friend, jokingly commented on how many people sort of turned and gasped as I used the phrase, the means of production. And she's like, you're a true Marxist, aren't you? I'm like, well, what I am is from West Oakland. And I know that we're hella poor down there and underserved and getting moved around like little pawns on a board. And the answer is, start your own. I just won't even put any derogatives at the end of that sentence. Just start your own. And so if that's Marxist, if that's re-inflaming class wars, then so be it. But the people who consider themselves in a different class, they're as much a prisoner to capital production as the so-called lower classes.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You're a hand servant to capital, whether you have Italian-made shoes or holes in your shoes.
Yeah, it's like we're all cogs in the machine in some way or another.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
The division is an illusion only in the magnitude of comfort that gets to cover up the fact that you are subject to the carceral state, that at any minute they can take anything from you that they so choose.
Right.
If I may add.
Yeah, please.
We're really about finding the heart-based people or the heart-centered people who want to work with us. Because in this class consciousness, like, there's a lot of different viewpoints and a lot of ways for, like, the whole picture to be obscured. And I want to give, like, two examples. In one case, like, speaking to some, like, African-American folks, like, there is a big fear about the unknown and about, we have to learn to trust each other again, is really like what it comes down to, is that because people don't know what this is, and it's not a McDonald's or something, so there isn't, like, you know, this brand recognition that they're used to, we have to basically put our model into action before some people will see it as a viable option. Another thing with the class consciousness is by convincing certain populations that frontline communities are the ones that are the places that we should start, and having it be like a given, as opposed to something that needs to be questioned or debated. It's been recommended to me that I begin to say frontline communities as opposed to Black, Indigenous, POC communities. The reason for that is because there's a tendency for folks to other themselves and say, where am I at? Like, I don't see myself in this Black, Indigenous, POC thing. Like, going to enslave the world with... let me not get too off track.
Yeah, please continue.
It's been really difficult. It's been really difficult to let people know that we have a rising tide lifts all boats, and you are included in this model. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're not looking at you first, because you're okay. Like if thinking of the Bay Area, if there's a flood going on, we're going to evacuate the people in the lowlands first, if we have a heart, as opposed to the people in the hills first, because they're on higher ground. So why would we not do that with the people placed at the lowest points in our societal caste system?
Yeah, I think that is probably I was thinking about this last night, thinking about equality versus equity, and thinking about this resistance sometimes when we do mention Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, and people, good friends, who say, does that mean not me? Because they happen to be white presenting or white defined individuals. When I first started in my field of anthropology, I came across a concept of underserved, right? And underserved is all of us. We know also, however, that the multicultural agenda, the needs of the Black and Indigenous person tends to fall to the bottom of the multicultural agenda, because most of our wounding, most of the things that need to be remediated in this American setting in general are fueled by a particular function of capitalism, which is called anti-Black racism. It does a special thing, and it actually affects and impacts all of us in such subtle, embedded ways that it is hard to parse it out and catch it unless you specifically set your filters for it. I mean, we're talking about how you purchase your makeup. We can go one step back, how makeup is manufactured. We can talk about the language we use to represent different things like financial status. So there's this embedded, there's this symbolism that works at almost what you might call a meta level in all functions of our society, have this anti-Black sort of ranking and evaluation system. In my field, you would call it a moral economy of value and exchange that, if not explicitly addressed, can't be uprooted. So when people are talking about divesting from capitalism, they also need to be talking about divesting from anti-Indigenous racism. Mm-hmm. Anti-Black racism. We could go down a long list, right? But in every situation, if you look at the Palestinians, if you look at the Kurds, you're gonna see this a very similar ranking system happening, and how people choose who to rescue, how we create immigration quotas, neighborhoods, right? So it has to be addressed for us to really authentically divest from it.
Part of why the focus is on people of color in your work ultimately is that we need to be sort of surfacing these things that haven't been explicitly addressed and therefore have simply been left to continue, you know, on sort of autopilot. And the way that capital works is that there is going to be that ranking that happens. And so, you know, addressing anti-Blackness, addressing anti-Indigenous, talking about capitalism, talking about class, like bringing all that stuff up to the surface and making it not an afterthought or a side note, but actually centering it in the work. It feels to me like there's a whole lot of that going on right now that feels like it absolutely has to happen. And it probably feels to a lot of people like ripping Band-Aids off things that they would just assume leave alone in this sort of weird, not very healed space, but at least I don't have to pay attention to it. And it feels really important to be actually like bringing that stuff up into the light. Is there other stuff that y'all want to say about why center your work on people of color, and particularly Black and Indigenous people?
So, as I mentioned, I'm a third-generation West Oakland native. Gregory is second or third. He lives within a few blocks of his family. He's from the flats of East Oakland. I'm from the flats of West Oakland. The two most economically and environmentally impacted areas in this Bay Area setup, right? We, in West Oakland, we are at the port. We are at the BART nexus. We are at the interstate nexus. So the particulates, the environmental noise, the asthma levels, the levels of municipal neglect, the low levels of academic achievement, the high levels of foreclosures, the rates of displacement. Gregory, what are the numbers for Black and people of color in terms of their rates of displacement at this point? It's something like we've lost 26% of the population?
Yeah, it's expected to fall from 50% of the population down to 16% in the next couple of years.
Wow.
Right. And we're talking about people who migrated here with their families in the 40s to work and serve in Oakland. People who, due to some HUD programs, did have ownership in the 70s and 80s and then became the first victims of predatory lending, illegal foreclosures, right? So we were talking about canaries in the mine, the people who are most affected, who are first in line for the lost, who are last in line for the gains. So when we first started this work, we got into a conversation about some of our mission work, and one of the phrases we were debating was this concept of deep diversity. And a person in our meeting made a comment such as, I'm interested in other kinds of diversity. My polite response to that was that I heard two things happening in that phrasing. One is, what I heard was code language for not Black. That's the most visceral experience. But I went on to talk about what other kinds of diversity really looks like in that light. And so I pointed out how with this influx of newcomers to the Bay Area, how extremely diverse my neighborhood has become. Tech workers, artists, weird bicycles, great parties, cool coffee shops, fresh ass punk shows, cool ciphers, but all these people living their fullest life, living diversely, gathering in warehouses and doing cool shit. Guess who you don't see among those crowds? Mm-hmm. Black people. So we've got every kind of diversity in the Bay Area except Black. How does other kinds of diversities function when specifically, structurally, repetitively, aesthetically, linguistically, a very specific group is by default excluded again and again?
Yep, that same group that used to be 50% of the population.
Right.
Right.
And who served here. Right? Uh-huh. We're not just talking about we exist. We're saying people have put their histories, their lives, their blood, their sweat, their children on the line to be here and contribute to this municipality. And there's structural interference generation after generation. There's embedded symbolic avarice toward those people's livelihoods being stable. The only models that people seem to be able to apply to Black, Brown, Indigenous is the charity model. And we know the charity model is a toxic model under capitalist production because it devalues the human being and it cuts off roots to the human being finding their highest expression of value because it gives them an either-or choice, either dependency or expulsion. So who will speak for those people if we who are from among those people don't? And we don't even seek to speak for them. We speak to create a room for them to speak for themselves. You can't speak in the voice of the people. You can enable people. And this is the difference between a charity model and a solidarity model, is we create a collective voice for ourselves and write our own stories to one another to heal the other stories told to all of us. And as I pointed out to the same person, the Panther movement, the Black Power story, has never been an exclusive story. Mm-hmm. It's always been a multicultural story. People like to be hyperbolic and phrase Black Power discussions as anti-white, but that's based in this inbuilt structure that whiteness is dependent on the negation of Blackness. When Blackness attempts to express itself positively, those who subscribe to that latter idea I mentioned do experience it as an exclusionary conversation. But if we understand that the story of Blackness has always been about creating an equitable ground, that there's nothing embedded in that mm-hmm. in an exclusionary fashion, except the resistance to historical and repetitive interference, right? This idea where people ask, why don't your communities do anything for yourselves? Why can't you guys lift yourself up?
Uh-huh.
This is the historical decontextualization.
Right. This is bad history.
The process we've experienced since emancipation. Immediately after emancipation, we had senators, we had a banking system, we had towns, literally. This is not a hyperbolic statement. Our wells were poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
Our towns were burned down
mm-hmm.
and bombed.
Right.
Our senators were smeared. Think about the president we had. There were death threats that were published in the New York Post. There was a cartoon shortly after his election of a New York cop shooting a chimpanzee on the streets of New York, and then it obliquely referenced Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You called our president a monkey and threatened his life by the hand of an agent of the state, and that was published.
You know, Noni, this concept that Blackness has always inherently been inclusive in how it's moved in the world. I mean, it seems to me that that's probably one of the reasons why it is so fundamentally threatening to whiteness, and to particularly with its deep ties to capitalism. You know, because capitalism is absolutely dependent on there being that hierarchy and having somebody at the bottom of the hierarchy. And so it seems like that is one of the critical reasons why it is so threatening to most white people.
Yeah, I mean, I just point out that our greatest leaders were not assassinated when they were pushing exclusionary politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's when the great Martin Luther King began to unite people around human rights
mm-hmm.
and anti-war politics. It's when the great Malcolm X returned from Mecca and understood that our endeavor was a universal endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
People are not killed for creating divisions. People are assassinated for breaking boundaries and breaking down walls. We are no threat to the capitalist owners, as they see themselves, of our life and livelihood and our future, as long as we are maintaining boundaries between people.
Noni, thank you. So Greg, what are you excited about?
Okay, I started working at the Sustainable Economies Law Center, like I said, to do outreach, education, and training in Black communities. And I am a week away from knowing whether or not I got a really big grant award that will allow for me to do book clubs, workshops, and trainings in East Oakland in collaboration with artist partners who are going to help me rewrite the script to make it more accessible to the youth. And I'm really hoping that long term I'll be able to create a arts incubator in a mall in East Oakland and begin to help creatives in the Bay Area in particular start to aggregate their resources and most importantly their cultural expression and be able to monetize it for themselves rather than have the same thing that we're used to where large record companies or large companies in any fashion are using extractive models to take what the artist has made and give them very little. California is it's a country in and of itself, but the arts industry in California is more than $1 billion industry and employs over 1 million people a year who are making about $100,000 a year. So I'm long-term wanting to help people of color, really everyone, but in particular Black people, to come together and bring their artistic resources in one place where we can start exercising some economies of scale and also collective bargaining so that more young creatives in Oakland are able to stay rather than being pushed out because they aren't able to afford the ridiculous housing prices here after high school.
If it wasn't clear, East Bay Prec is an investment cooperative, and the intention is to create community solidarity funds, if you will, but they're actually investment funds where we return the profit, modest return, 1.5%, but the Sustainable Economies Law Center worked very hard to help change an important securities law where individuals can now invest up to $1,000 apiece into cooperative endeavors. And with those numbers, we are, as of November 9th, we are launching and opening our doors to public investment. We're looking for 400 to 4,000 community investors to aggregate money into this fund, where we will be housing collective groups democratically, nonviolently, in pieces of property in Oakland that we stabilize and keep off the speculative market. So if they can go to EBPREC, that is ebprec.org, and take the pledge to support this community fund and to support community-driven development, development that happens within the community vision, that would be really great. The most important part about it is the groups that we select to house are groups that are not just Black, Indigenous, and POC. They're also groups that are already serving diligently in Oakland. So our hope is to amplify and stabilize their services so that we can direct our vision and agitate in Oakland from a sovereign and stable place where we can't be displaced or dispossessed as we move our vision of the community forward. So please go to ebprec.org and take the pledge today.
And Greg, let us know if you get the grant. It'll probably be a week or two before we're able to actually get this interview up, and it would be great to be able to toss that update in for people if it turns out that you did get it, so it can be, you know, not just here's what you want to do, but like here's what Greg has, you know, just gotten support to be able to actually do. So we would be happy to make sure to do an extra shout out for you when we air this. So
I think I have just one more thing to say. The really cool thing about our model is that if once we're able to get money at 1.5% rather than the 4.5, 5.5, 6.5% that the bank is offering for commercial loans, we're able to reduce rents by up to 40%. And what we're hoping, or like what we've modeled, is a triple bottom line where folks are getting a small return for their profit, basically what they would be getting in a money market account for the term that they leave it in the cooperative. And in addition to that, like Noni said, there's like doing a world of service for the community by helping to institutionalize and root the people who are there on the ground, like making the community better and advancing like these heart-based initiatives like we're talking about. Because like we're so intentional about healing and about the environment, we have an ambitious plan to like do remediation for the environment as well, and making sure that our properties are not doing more harm to Mother Earth than we have to. So like our goals are to get to, you know, carbon neutral. Many of the properties that we'll be acquiring are old properties and will need to be brought up to that standard. Mm-hmm. But that is our long-term goal.
Wonderful. That's great. And I would actually love to talk more with both of you, because the FIC is actually talking about doing a kind of national scale similar project where we'd be able to actually work with those organizations that are already on the ground trying to do this work. So we're not trying to take over that work, but are trying to make something like this accessible for people all over the country, you know, rather than, you know, just there's a few pockets of this kind of stuff happening in different places, but it tends to be the more rural places where there's not access to anything like this to help groups get landed. So, but that's a conversation for another day. I'd love to talk more with both of you about all kinds of stuff. Do you want to give any more websites or anything else that people should know about contact-wise?
ebprec.org to take the pledge today. If you have questions, if you want us to come speak to your group about it, if you want to have a coffee to pass on information and learn more, reach out to us at info@ebprec.org. And we are holding orientations at 1428 Franklin on first and third Wednesdays for the rest of the year. And we have a few advisory council happy hours coming up. And you can check our website, ebprec.org, for more information.
Right on.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah.
And I'd also advise for people to sign up for our newsletter. Signing up for the pledge won't get you on the newsletter, but we'd love to keep you all updated on all the cool things we're doing. We send out a newsletter once or two times.
Awesome.
We're Solidarity House on Patreon and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.